Gonna have a real good time together. We're gonna have a real good time together. We're gonna laugh and shout together. Have a real good time together. Na 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 na.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Jokerman Podcast. I'm Evan.
I'm Ian, and we're thrilled once again to be joined by returning champion. Folks, it's Larry Ratso Sloman.
Great to be here.
The pleasure is all ours, truly. And we're here tonight to, instead of just a big, broad overview of all of the trials and travails of Ratso, we're going to focus on one more specific kind of subject, although I'm sure we're going to get to talk about quite a bit. It's artificial intelligence, John Cale's 1985 album, co-written, I think entirely every song on the album, co-written with one Larry Sloman.
Yeah, pretty much.
That is incredible and not something that many folks in the world can say, collaborating with John Cale on music. It's you, it's Lou Reed, it's the other people from the Velvets, it's Brian Eno. That's about it.
It's a short list.
Bobby Newhart, that's right. Last Day on Earth. Well, so how did, I guess, can you, before we even get into the record, can you just kind of give us a rundown of like how you and John got to know each other and found yourselves working together? Because this wasn't the first time you guys had done some co-writing. There were some credits on Caribbean Sunset and I think even on Comes Alive earlier. So give it to us. Yeah.
Yes. So basically, we met through Kinky Friedman. Mm-hmm. Kinky had a residency at the Lone Star Cafe. And I had come off the Rolling Thunder tour in 75. Did the book On the Road, Bob Dylan, in 78. And I started, I was so inspired on that tour. I started writing lyrics. I mean, I couldn't really write music because I didn't know how to play guitar. I didn't, you know. But I actually wrote a song on that tour.
On Rolling Thunder.
Wow. Called Combat Zone, because it's a long story how I basically quit the tour. I was covering for Rolling Stone and they were just hassling me. And if you want to see it, it's all in documented in the Scorsese documentary about Rolling Thunder. It's on Netflix. But so basically, they gave me a job, so to speak, but they gave me a room here every night and they gave me per diem so I could stay on the road and write the book. And one time Bob said, go to Boston and see if you could find some hookers for a scene we're going to do for the movie.
For a movie.
Not only were they touring, they were doing a movie, which became Ronaldo and Clara.
And Clara, of course.
So I went to, I spent two nights in the combat zone, they call it, which is where all the pornos, you know, it's like their version of Times Square.
In Boston. Smaller.
Yeah, in Boston. And I got to know, you know, all the guys who own the strip clubs. Hung out at the Howard Johnson's, which was open 24 hours, where all the hookers would go. They used to barricade the bathrooms so the hookers couldn't go in and give blowjobs to people. But, when I finally lined up all these people and Bob said, oh, we're going in another direction. So I said, I have all this data I accumulated. I should write a song about these people in the combat zone. And that's what I did. So I finished the song. I think I showed it first to McGuinn. And McGuinn liked it. And McGuinn said, hey, I'll write some music for it. And I showed it to Bob. I think it was on the train ride from Toronto to Montreal. And Bob reads the lyrics. And he goes, this is good. He said, this reminds me of Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues. So it was like, I couldn't get, wow, that's fantastic. So
that's high praise.
I'm going to keep doing this. We eventually played a couple of times. Me and McGuinn went up to Bob Fass's show at the WBAI, which was the Pacifica station, you know, and actually performed Combat Zone. And Mitch Blank, the keeper of all the tapes of Dylan and everybody else in the world, he's like hypnotist collector. So Mitch Blank actually has versions of the from Bob Fass's sound checks of me and McGuinn doing Combat Zone.
Wow.
So when I got back, when the tour was over and I finished the book and everything, I started hanging out with Liz Derringer, who was on the scene in the village. And Liz said, you should meet my husband, Rick. He's always looking to write songs with people. So I said, okay. And I actually started doing writing lyrics for Rick. And we did about 10, 15 songs together. They're all collected, actually. You could hear them on my Spotify page, and it's just Ratso, just like, you know, Madonna or
just or one name only. That's all you need.
That's right. That's all I need. And there's I made a list of put all those songs on it. So if you want to hear the Derringer collaborations, they were up there. And so Kinky was at that time was staying in the city. He had a residency at the Lone Star, and we met a bunch of crazy people through that. I mean, I met all the New York Rangers one day after a game.
The hockey team, the New York Rangers.
And I was the only person at the Lone Star who knew who they were. Come on, Ed, because I was a big hockey fan. I had written a book on the Rangers. So we got friendly. Bill Clinton came once. We didn't even know who he was.
Bill Clinton, the next president, one of the presidents of the United States.
It was before, it's when he was governor. And Bill Clinton came in to the Lone Star during there was a Democratic convention that year, was in New York. And he had made a keynote speech or something. And afterwards, he's a good old boy, and he came to see Kinky. And so we got friendly through that. And then, Mickey Mantle came one night. It was just, you couldn't believe the diverse group of people.
Wow.
And one of them was John Cale. So Kinky introduced me to Cale. And we were talking, and I told him about Derringer or something. And Cale said, well, you know, why don't we try to write some songs together? I said, great, sure. Yeah, I was a big fan of the Velvet Underground.
Sure.
Pretty good band.
Kale solo work. So, and we started, we wrote in every conceivable way you could kind of collaborate. We did it together. We did it from scratch, writing songs from scratch. We did it where he gave me some music and I kind of wrote some lyrics to it, like a crossword puzzle or something, we just had a lot of fun doing that. I guess we started trying, I guess the first one, you're right, was Caribbean Sunset. And on that album, it was that and Where There's a Will, There's a Way.
Mm-hmm. That's a great song.
And then we did, I know we did Then that Kale Comes Alive album, I think we did Ooh La La.
Ooh La La. We just talked about that recently. We're big fans of Ooh La La.
About the girls in Saint-Tropez going topless in the sun, I practiced staring every day so I could hypnotize each one. Dominique, she owns a factory, and Bridget, she lives in a truck. And there's a lot that can be said for those hard-working girls that would like to walk my Peking duck.
Can you please give us what's some background on Ooh La La? What do you remember, like what was John what was
thinking?
He thinking? Or at least what did he say about it, if anything?
Where'd well, that go? I mean, you know, we wanted to write a song about all the girls at Saint-Tropez going topless in the sun.
Easy as that.
So I'd never been to Saint-Tropez. I guess he had. So we just, you know, started throwing lines out together and came up with Ooh La La. And then when I heard the finished version, it was hilarious. Just great the way he put the music to that.
But it doesn't sound like anything really before or after. It seems like a lot of this stuff that you worked on with him kind of is singular. Like there's things he did working with you that I don't know that he ever did again. It seemed to access some part of John Cale that only you could access.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was probably a function of the times and the drugs we were taking at the time. But, you know, skipping forward a little bit, but the first song on Artificial Intelligence is called Every Time the Dog Barks.
Yep. Yeah.
And that's based on a true incident. We would hang out at Mary Lou's, which was this really cool bar in the West Village. There were many people who purveyed substances at that bar.
Of course.
And I had a friend who'll go nameless, but used to, he dubbed himself the ladies' room as attendant. He would lure girls into the ladies' room with a line or two of blow, and then he would tattoo them with a Bic pen for some reason.
Okay.
And one time he did that to a mafioso guy's wife, and he almost got him killed. I mean, the Tommy, who was the owner, Mary Lou's brother, had to intervene and save his life. But those were kind of crazy shit that was going on those days. So we were driving home once from Mary Lou's to my house because we were going to, let's do some more writing. So, and we had a little packet of Peruvian marching powder. So I'm driving a little Toyota Corolla, I think I had that. We went around the park down by Washington Square Park, and we're coming down West Broadway, and there was a summer night. I know I had the windows open, and it was desolate. There was nobody on the street, but there was a dog that had been tied up outside the Morton Williams grocery store. I think it was called something else then, but it was an all-night grocery store.
Hmm.
The dog was just barking. And I didn't realize it, but when I made the turn off the park, I ran a red light. And all of a sudden, I see a cop car behind us, and the lights go on. And we're about to hit right where the Bleecker Street, where the next light is, and I'm going to John. Oh, shit, what am I going to do? How can I get rid of this pack? What am I going to do? What am I going to do? And John looks at me and goes, Ratso, the dogs are barking. He just repeated that 9 times. So, yeah, I had it in my pocket, I guess, and the cop goes, he says, you know what you did? And I said, oh, officer, I'm so sorry. I must have ran that red light. I just live 2 blocks away, and, you know, in Soho, and I'm really so sorry. I was just trying to get home. We're really tired. And he goes, all right, just don't do it again. Thank God. And we got back, and I think yeah. And then he wrote most of the lyrics to that. Every time the dogs bark, that's the one. I don't even know if I got credit for that one, but that's the one aberration on that album.
Sure.
But there was we also did. I remember John called me up and said, "There's this movie, Sid and Nancy."
Mm-hmm.
And they want a song. Let's write a song about for the movie. So I said, okay, great. What should we do? And I think I said, you know, everybody's going to write about Sid. Let's write a song about Nancy.
Mm.
And because she's a world class pain in the ass. And so that's what we wrote. And it was too late. It was called She Never Took No for an Answer.
Mm-hmm.
There's a parking lot viper alone in the dream, a fabulous disaster of an underground queen. She never took no for an answer. Never took no for an answer.
And we finished the song, but it was too late to actually get it in the movie. But they put it in the soundtrack. So if you have the soundtrack of Sid and Nancy, there's She Never Took No for an Answer. And that was one of the real fun collaborations we did together. So that really brings us, I think, pretty much up to artificial intelligence.
And yeah, there's a lot of things like that around this time that we've noticed. Like there's a Lou Reed did a song for a movie. It seems like there's kind of a willingness to just take those opportunities and run with them.
Which well, seems... yeah. I mean, first of all, this is, you know, it's supposed to be like a countercultural movie.
Mm.
And so, you know, it's not like you're writing a Disney movie, a song yeah. for a Disney movie. It's not like you're, you know, writing a song for Shrek or something.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned Shrek because when John Cale actually has a song in Shrek.
Yeah, of course. And that's a whole other story. I mean,
yeah.
Talk about how that happened. But
this is the first time John wrote for a movie, which would become something he did a lot, or did scores
well,
and
I mean,
all kinds of things.
Yeah, but
yeah, more scores than songs.
Yeah. Scores.
Oh yeah, he was doing a lot of scores. Yeah. But one day John calls me and says, "Give me all the lyrics you have laying around." I said, "Why?" He said, "I'm going to England to produce an album for Nico." And he said, "I'm actually going to finish the album 2 weeks before they contracted an X amount of time." says, I'm going to finish the album for Nico 2 weeks early. So give me all the things you have, and I want to do another album. Basically, because the time was paid for already.
Wow.
Wow.
So I give him, you know, everything I have, you know, all these the different lyrics. And he goes off, and he comes back like a month later, and he plops a cassette down, and he goes, here's the album. And I started listening to the album. And it was amazing because he had done kind of like a Burroughs, Geeson cut-up thing. Where, you know, some of the songs he took verses from one song, took verses from another song, and made it into a new kind of song.
New song.
Yeah, but all, you know, using all, pretty much all the lyrics, but just rearranging them and things like that. Some of them was completely like Dying on the Vine, he didn't touch. You know,
wow.
I think Dying on the Vine, he changed a couple of lyrics. I think the original was, I was living out in Hollywood. I was dying on the vine. Mm. And he made it, I was living like a Hollywood.
Yeah, such an interesting line.
Which was a great,
sticks out.
Yeah.
It's a fun double meaning. I mean, if we want to just get into that song, having just talked about the first track, I mean, I really have to say, Dying on the Vine was one of the first songs that I really got enamored with John Cale over, and I really loved that song, and then wanted to go and hear all of it. But it's, you know, one of his best songs, and it's actually one of your songs. You know, it's, I just have to tell you, it's like one of my very favorites.
Dying on the Vine was occasioned by I had a big crush on this girl that I'd met, who her sister was living at the Chelsea Hotel, and her older sister, and I had the crush on the younger sister, and the older sister had a room at the Chelsea, and she was just getting over a bad divorce. And she had a little daughter. I wound up hanging out with the three of them, and then the younger sister kind of faded. And then I started like going out with the older sister. We eventually got together and lived together for 3 or 4 years. But Dying on a Vine was my kind of experience of trying to get close to this woman who was going through a difficult time in terms of relationships and letting herself be vulnerable again after this really horrific breakup. And so that was, you know, I said it almost like in wartime, and it was like, you know, I've been chasing ghosts, and I just, you know, I mean, it was all these images of kind of the futility of trying to, you know, make a connection with this person. I wish I had the lyrics here. I mean, I could go.
I could put them up on the screen. I've got them right in front of me. I can put them on the screen if you want.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, please.
Look at that.
So I was with you down in Acapulco. Yeah, I think her name was Judy. I think that way, at one point we went down to Mexico together. And the William Burroughs line was added by John.
Sure.
So I was with you down in Acapulco trading clothing for some wine, smelling like an old adobe woman, or a William Burroughs playing for lost time. John had added that line. The genesis of this, I was thinking about my mother. I was thinking about what's mine. I was living like a Hollywood. I was dying in the vine. Was actually another song years earlier we weren't writing a song, but me, Tom Waits, and Chucky Weiss. I was out in Hollywood after the Dylan tour. So it was about 76, 77. And the three of us were hanging out a lot. I was at the Continental Hyatt House. And and we said, let's write a song. You know, we're just joking around. Let's trade lines and write a song. And okay. And I think I called it, let's call it Mother's Day at the Orphanage. So that's, we wrote like nonsense lyrics. I mean, you know, little Johnny was in the corner, blah, 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 you know. And each one, you know, we were just having fun. And then when it came time for a chorus, I just came up with, I was thinking about my mother. I was thinking about what's mine. I was living like a Hollywood. Well, I was living out in Hollywood. I was dying in the vine because I was out in Hollywood then.
Sure.
And and then, you know, so when it came time, to actually write the song with John, or for John, eventually it would become for John. I was going through my lyrics and I found these nonsense lyrics from me and Waits and Chucky Weiss. And I said, that's a great, I love that chorus. Let's just throw it in there.
Wow. So the nut of this song is from like a decade prior when you were just riffing around with Tom Waits.
Yes.
It's amazing.
And Chucky Weiss. Yes.
It really feels like so together. The whole song just works so well together. You would never know that it was like has all these like key points that kind of from all over the map.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, I mean, that's the way songs get written. I mean, you know, like Kinky would always carry around a Big Chief tablet. Whenever he'd hear something on the street, he'd take notes and stuff like that. Dylan does the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, if you go to Tulsa, to the Dylan Center, and you can actually see some of the, you know, the permutations of how songs came about. Yeah, I mean, you know, he'll have little scraps of paper where he'll write, you know, little things, cross them out, and, you know, despite, you know, when he tells Leonard Cohen, oh, I wrote that song in 15 minutes in a cab or whatever. I mean, you know, he puts the work in.
He's
just
a liar.
Like great, you know, lyricist still. So we had that. So I put that, I was thinking about my mother thing in. And then I got back to this this wartime motif. Who could sleep through all that noisy chatter, the troops, the celebrations in the sun? The authorities say my papers are all in order. And if I wasn't such a coward, I would run.
One of the best, one of my favorite lyrics of all time, frankly. If I wasn't such a coward, I would run.
Such a great verse. It feels like Casablanca or something like that.
You
know,
like
it's
like
hopelessly
romantic, but doomed. Like
exactly.
Or like Under the Volcano or something. It has Yeah.
And then, you know, then the last verse is, you know, I'll see you when all the shooting's over. Meet me on the other side of town. Yes, you could bring all your friends along for protection, which was something that Judy would do. I mean, she would have, like, I go to visit her and she have like three other friends there at that time. So I, you know, I would kind of make it sarcastic. It's always nice to have them hanging around.
Yeah.
And, you know, in, I don't know if it came across that much in John's version, but when I did my version on my album of Dying on the Vine, I made it clear that, you know, it's a sardonic comment. It's always nice to have
Yeah, you're never going to have that intimate romantic moment. It's always going to be like buffered.
Yeah, John's a little more kind of stately and reserved on this one, which, you know, makes sense for his kind of approach and his kind of vibe. But it's definitely, I think there's a, he really kind of plays this pretty straight and serious as kind of funny and you know, oddball as it can be.
I think at the time, I remember John telling me at the time why he connected so much to the song, because I think his mother was ill.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really weighing on his mind. Wow. And so he really connected to the chorus. I was thinking about my mother. I was thinking about what's mine.
Yeah, it's a really remarkable track just because, like, you know, we know, obviously, and you do too, right? So, and yeah, this was mostly from your pen, your handiwork, lyrically speaking. But, like, if you're just looking at it on the surface, on the face of it, I'm just thinking about like where John was at in his life, and so, like, it feels intensely personal, like it, you know, came directly from his life experiences and the shit that he was going through, and right down to like the mother line, like you were saying, and yet obviously, you know, it came from you, and I think there's just really something magic about like this particular set of lyrics and this song just kind of making its way to him at this moment in time. It's serendipity, it's kismet or something.
Yeah. And, you know, years later, it's funny because I forgot how I met, but I started corresponding with Jonathan Lethem, novelist.
Mm-hmm.
And, I know what it was. There was a book that it was like novelists who were influenced by music while they were writing a book. And Lethem wrote how one of his early novels, he said, during the whole writing process of that novel, all I did was listen to Dying on the Vine by John Cale. And so I wrote him and I said, hey, I don't know if you know it, but I wrote the lyrics to that. And it blew his mind. I mean, he couldn't believe it. He said, you're kidding. Oh my God! I thought that was, you know, because like you're saying, it really, John, you know, inhabited that song. So, so we got friendly after that. It's funny. He's a great guy, Lethem.
Boy, you got the longest Rolodex. A couple other just fascinating tracks on artificial intelligence. I got. Oh, but on that note, also, just like the title of the record, did you have any?
Yeah,
especially right now in 2023, this feels like a very appropriate record to be chatting about. Did you have any impact on just like literally calling it artificial intelligence?
No, but neither did John.
Really?
Neither did John.
No.
What do you mean?
Jonathan Demme.
What?
Called it artificial intelligence.
Whoa.
Why? How did that happen?
Well, where does Jonathan Demme come in?
Jonathan Demme was over at Cale's house. Cale played him the album. And Demme said, you got to call this artificial intelligence.
Was that a joke about it not being written by him?
So that's how we got the name. But neither of us came up with that name.
Wow.
Was he making some kind of reference to the fact that John didn't write the lyrics? That it was like him?
No. No, not at all. I mean, he just, I guess for some reason, I mean, you know, he was a pioneer in, you know, finding out about artificial intelligence. I guess he just read a book about artificial intelligence or something. Who knows? But he said that, you know, that's what the music and the song sounded to him like.
Fascinating.
That would be an appropriate title for that.
But
it was originally to be called Black Rose, I think. That was the working title. At least that's what I have read.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah, the title would have been, the song.
Black Rose was a song about a very precocious woman, young woman. And, well, we can talk about that when we...
Well, let's talk about it. I got the lyrics right here. I'll throw them up on the screen. What do you got for us? Let's just we're getting a peek into the mind of the master here. That's what we're here for.
Everybody's melting, but the heat just won't affect you.
under factors are here to take your picture away.
So and it was a hot summer in New York City. So everybody's melting, but the heat just won't affect you. Backlot Casanovas and Black Russian defectors are here to take your picture away. I know you don't have much space left on your windowsill. That's a reference to my apartment on Soho, and I had a lot of tchotchkes on the windowsill.
So, easy as that.
She never seemed to be sweating during the heat waves.
Wow.
And then Black Rose Longthorn, White Rose Stillborn. Longthorn, I think, if I could remember correctly, was a reference to her nipples.
Wow.
And White Rose Stillborn was a reference to our relationship.
Oh, man.
She was the Black Rose. I was the White Rose. Standing on the corner, just banging at the moon. Just another little miss too much, far too soon.
Man.
And it's you know, it's not the most
so good.
Positive. I think when I eventually told her about this song, she didn't care that she was a little miss too much, far too soon. Anyway, Dream Street Romance is not the same as Burning Love. You could light 1,000 candles. You could wear your satin glove. That was a reference to Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson.
Yeah. Satin glove.
And you could dance from here to Sunday. You could dance from here to Sunday.
This is a great song, Radso.
Yeah, I always liked this song, I don't remember, but if you read it, that John was going to call it Black Rose.
Yeah, that's what I read. It really does feel like, you know, it's one of the more tender and gentle moments on the record, and it does feel like kind of holds some of the center of gravity of the album. It's very romantic.
I'm a stone romantic.
I can tell
it was John.
Sure, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, he really, yeah, really, like, again, inhabits this song and gives it. I mean, learning that Black Rose Longthorn is about her nipples.
Well, apparently. I don't think he knows.
Well, but that's exactly it, right? Is that, like, he can take a line like that came from one very specific place in your brain and give it just a totally fucking different feel and different vibe going through his mind and the way that he vocalizes.
Oh,
it.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and he, you know, he's got such a nimble and inventive mind that just little touches here and there just come, you know, completely
give him a new meaning. You gave him more than enough to work with. I mean, it's like practically already all there. And the ways in which he, you know, I frankly, it's just, you know, being a big fan of John Cale and like Jonathan Latham, maybe like it doesn't seem like he would be the type of person who would allow himself to work that closely with someone else. Like it seems like he would be the type to pride his writing and have it be very personal and not want to cede that to anybody else. But that's apparently not the case in every situation. It is.
Well,
really,
look at his new album. He's got all these collaborators on his new album.
Yeah, like every song's got a different collaborator. Yeah. I think collaboration actually has been kind of in John's bones from the very beginning, working with Lou the way that he did, right? Doing all the production work.
Well, and he was working with Lou, and angle. Then he worked. You were his Lou Reed for this period of time. I mean, that's just how it went. It's true.
He's particular about who he wants to work with, right? And
right.
So, like, Eno, Lou, you know, Patti Smith, the Stooges, I guess even, Ratso. Like, if you're the right kind of person, he's down to work with you. Nico, obviously. It's real murderer's row.
You know, and years later, when I put out my album, right before the pandemic, I was being interviewed by somebody who's, I think it's Billboard, a guy from Billboard did a piece and interviewed me. And then he actually called up Cale's manager and told her, you know, I'm doing a piece on Rat Silver on his album, and I'd love to talk to John, get a quote from John.
Mm.
And John gave him a quote, and when I read it, it just blew my mind. I mean, it was like such a beautiful, generous quote where he talked about, you know, I was fortunate to be working with a world-class lyricist, compared me to Dylan.
Wow.
I mean,
wow.
It was like, I couldn't believe it when I, you know, because, you know, he's maybe it's a function of, you know, getting older or whatever, but, you know, he never was that effusive at the time. I mean, he seemed, you never knew what kind of reaction you would get from John. Not in a bad way, but, you know, and to give that, you know, 3 or 4 sentence thing to Billboard, I mean, it was just, it blew me away. I mean, I was so thrilled by that.
I've actually got just pulled up the quote here real quick. I'd love to read it just because it really is a remarkable kind of statement from John.
Oh, yeah. Great.
He says, there are not many people with a natural bent for absorbing mood prose, even less that seem to walk in shoes as august as those of Bob Dylan. For that moment in time with Ratso, an album was made with a lyrical co-conspirator of the highest order.
Wow.
What a great quote.
Yeah. I mean, I was just thrilled. I mean, you know. He's a mensch, you know. He really is a great guy.
Mensch is the way to describe him, absolutely.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, he's got so many. I mean, like, you know, over the years, you know, we would, you know, especially after we moved to L.A., so we would just communicate through emails.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was always into, well, you could tell from some of his work, but he was always into, you know, high-end espionage and, he knew websites like Stratford, which was websites that were, made for corporations to kind of protect, their interests from, terrorist attacks and things like that. He had friends, Israeli friends in the Mossad. So, I mean, you know, he just had such a...
John had friends in the Mossad?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he was in the Mossad, yeah.
Does that have some... When we were talking about Caribbean Sunset, there's that song... You mentioned something about Israeli and Arab politics.
Yeah, they wrote in the book that an arms dealer from Lebanon came and visited them in the studio.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about why that happened. I think we just glazed over, like, well, okay, that happened.
Well,
like,
knowing now that he apparently had friends in the Mossad, that makes perfect sense.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Jesus.
Well, this is great. You guys have this well of information at your fingertips.
We, you know, someone's got to do it. One other song I want to make sure that we talk about, because this is one of my favorite songs on the record, and it to me, it's a really fascinating lyric, is the third song right after Dying on the Vine, The Sleeper.
Okay.
I can throw the lyrics up on the screen for this one, too.
That's one of the cut-ups. The first two verses are from one song, which is, might have been Vigilante Lover,
mm-hmm.
I think. That was my original song, Vigilante Lover. I gave him lyrics to that. But your mailbox is always empty and your landlords always complain. You try to forget your past, but it's just adding to your pain and it's time for one more cigarette. And then I Am the Sleeper was John's.
Interesting.
I Am the Sleeper. I Am the Sleeper. All of a sudden, I Am the Sleeper comes into the song that I, you know, I didn't know what it was, what that was, but it was great.
Yeah, that to me has always been the part that's like, what the fuck is he talking about? I'm the sleeper. Like, it's such a fascinating phrase, and the way that he just kind of plugs it in there in between verses, like, seems really significant to me. So I guess it makes sense that that's a Johnism.
Right. And then, it used to feel so right. Everything seemed new. I haven't changed. It isn't me. Isn't what me. Is wrong with you? Is from a song called "What Is Wrong with You," and so he just took four lines from that song. And then again, I am the sleeper. And then, so the sun came up, and you come back. The door was open wide. I should have slammed in your face. I should have shot you in the back. That's what Jesus would have done if Satan had come and looked him in the eye and said, "You're my kind of guy. Why don't you come away with me? Because I love you. I love you." That's what she said. "I love you. I love you. I'd rather speak to Satan himself."
I love that verse. That whole thing is just amazing.
Right.
That's right. What she said.
And then he's the sleeper.
He's the sleeper. All right.
Turns out John's the sleeper.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fascinating song that kind of you could turn around again and again and find different little things to love about it. It's musically, it's really, and we haven't really talked much about like the sound of the record, but it's a very unique sounding album. Like the whole thing has kind of this like sounds that are popular in the 80s, but they're not being used like most people are using them.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't sound like it. It's got a lot of synthesizers, got a lot of kind of synthesized percussion and stuff like that, but deployed in a very kind of John-like right. manner, very stately, you know, very measured.
What's the next song after Sleepo?
That's Vigilante Lover. Here we go. Because this is he's rocking at this point. There's a little more kind of edge to this one.
What inspired the idea of Vigilante Lover?
It's a woman. I mean,
well, yeah,
it's all,
yeah.
I'm seeing a common theme emerge here.
Vigilante is just such a. It's a. There is, I think the what is it the. Is it New Order has a song called "Love Vigilantes,"
which that's a great song.
No, I never heard
came
that.
After even, but
I think it had something to do with the subway vigilante in New York City.
Oh, really?
But because like in the verse 3, the air was heavy over the village square. That that's didn't take place, but that. Is written about Paris and about the people around the Brittany girl.
Wow.
It's not every day they auction off despair. There were voices floating in the country air, secret policemen watching everywhere. Anyone could have cracked the code. Anyone could have cracked the code. That's all from
lines in here.
That's fascinating. Because that verse in particular really fucking screams John's Mossad connections and fascinations.
Yeah, that espionage
yes, and like spy right. shit.
But that's not.
That's not him, yeah.
And the next verse, I drive a stolen car. I got a monkey jaw that makes the blood run cold. I see through windows, but nothing can touch me at all.
What's a monkey jar?
Yeah, can you tell us what a monkey jar is? A woman's breasts.
I think that was a kale phrase.
Okay.
I see through windows, hear through walls, but nothing you can touch me at all. But I wouldn't feel so forlorn. There must be some saving grace. I hear the Rosicrucians just hit town. They're all
the Rosicrucians. Feet. Was that you?
Yeah.
Wow. Brittany girl again?
No, that was a Vigilante Lover.
Wow. Okay.
Well, it's all Vigilante Lover at this point.
Yeah.
Well, it's John's Vigilante Lover.
Yeah, there's a couple love vigilantes at
yes,
work here.
But now the Rosicrucians, because you know, I at that time I was reading a lot of the occult stuff, Manly Hall and stuff like that.
Wow, that's something you're still interested in?
Oh yeah, sure. now it's mostly I read it kind of with detachment, and it's, you know, it's, and a lot of that stuff is like just crazy shit that I like to read, like
sure.
conspiracy theories and stuff like that. You know, that David Icke's that moron, and
yeah,
you know,
the lizard people.
Yeah, of course. You know, it's
David
it's
Icke.
So...
But yeah, I think he. Yeah, I think John really loved the being able to sing the word Rosicrucians.
Oh,
yeah, that is a word made for John Cale to sing.
Also, just have to say,
what's the next song?
Oh, the next one was Chinese Takeaway, Hong Kong 97, which is
instrumental.
Lacking.
it's just a fun instrumental.
Right.
He's putzing around, and then we go into Song of the Valley.
Pretty much verbatim, I gave him the Song of the Valley.
Sure.
I remember I was reading, let's see, I was reading, I guess it was because I had seen how much the Bible had influenced people like Dylan, you know, his whole career. So I decided, by the way, the Song of the Valley, I think, originally, it was called Dry Bones.
Dry Bones?
Yes.
Is that a line in here?
No, no. I don't know, but I originally titled the song Dry Bones.
Huh.
They say that love is like a flower that bows so graceful to the light, but I've seen most true love go sour and then blossom in the dead of night. I can't be certain of the hour who will bear that final kiss. I must assume there's a power who can deliver me to them.
Man, I mean, did you start writing lyrics? Like, when did you really start to just decide that you really wanted to do it? Was it not until you were doing the Rolling Thunder tour that you really just...
I did some satirical songs before that for because I was friendly with Thule Kufferberg from the Fugs.
Oh, wow.
Thule would do these parrot songs, and they were just kind of like parodies of... other songs, and I remember it wasn't a parody of another song, but I remember the time there was this young Guru Maharaji, who was touring the States, and Rennie Davis from the Chicago 7, first the Chicago 8, but then they got rid of Bobby Seale, so it was the Chicago 7. So Rennie Davis became, after all the war was over and everything, he became a devotee of this little fat young guru. And it was Maharaji. And I wrote a kind of satirical song about Guru Maharaji. He really wants you and me. He may be fat, but he's fun. And I gave it to Thule. And so that was like the first, you know, real parodies or real songs. But they were parodies. They weren't really, really lyrics.
Yeah, this is no parody. I mean, these are like real deal lyrics that are, you know, I would just say like a lot of these, if you read them and told me they were Dylan lyrics, I wouldn't necessarily doubt it. I mean...
Well, I mean, you know, look, how could you not be influenced by, you know, your subconscious.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
I mean, you know, I was, you know, a Dylan devotee, you know.
It's just not everybody can actually do it just by being, just by admiring it. Like, yeah. I really feel like these do, like, you know.
I always, to me, I mean, there was nothing like writing lyrics. I mean, I was writing, you know, books, you know, I had, you know, books that were in the windows of Barnes and Noble, you know, when they came out, stuff like that. Like my hockey book, Thin Ice, was a big bestseller in the New York tri-state area because it was about the Rangers. And but to me, there was nothing like sitting at the bottom line and watching Cale sing your lyrics. I mean, to me, that was a thrill that was beyond anything from a, you know, doing a book tour or some shit like that.
Hell yeah.
So, yeah, so, I mean, that's why, you know, to me, it was always so much fun to just, you know, work on lyrics. And to this day, I mean, it's a tremendous amount of fun. See, Song of the Valley, yeah, I guess he named it Song of the Valley because it was, I think originally it was Dry Bones.
Interesting.
And that was an image that was in the Bible.
Sure. A couple more. We got Fade Away Tomorrow.
Okay.
Love that's here today, fade away tomorrow. Love that's here today, fade away tomorrow. Love that's here today, fade away tomorrow.
Love that's here today.
Okay, so this is an homage to Roxy Music.
Ah, all right, I see that.
Okay.
And in these lyrics, I'm really trying to ape Brian Ferry.
Sure.
So, you know, and I could just, you know, I could see Ferry singing. You know, they say every dog has its day, but puppy love was never my way.
Yeah, that really does sound like a Ferry lyric, doesn't it?
Yeah, I hear your voice. Am I asleep or awake since you've gone? Love that's here today, fade away tomorrow. So yeah, that is all you know, this homage to Ferry. And I, you know, I don't know whether I even told John that. You know, I just gave, you know, fade away tomorrow was just another lyric I gave him.
Sure.
And then, but you know, it really sounds like a you know, like an early Roxy Music song.
Yeah, totally.
Sounds like it could be on the first or second album.
Yeah, or like a Robert Palmer record. It has just kind of this, it's very buoyant. It's the poppiest song on the record. It's one of his poppiest songs, period, yeah. I think.
Right. And then I put in that line in the second verse, here she comes full of white light and heat.
I was going to say, that's got to be, you're clearly referencing White Light, White Heat there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And with the walk that could stop the cars in the street. And, you know, and that's another, that's a Ferry-ism.
Right.
Yeah, yeah,
but, so, you know, John could have had another career as, you know, sort of a, you know, Lothario, you know, world-weary sex pot type of guy, like the way that Ferry did after Roxy Music.
Except he was world-weary because he was thinking about international espionage.
Right, yeah. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict, apparently.
That's right.
Oh, man. Well, and then we got Black Rose after that, which we talked about, right. And then the record wraps on Satellite Walk. Which, I love this song, and it's just got some absolutely bonkers lines in here. So are these, can you tell us, Rats, are these you, are these John, are these both you?
No, this Satellite Walk, to best of my recollection, was one of the songs that we did around the time of Ooh La La.
Okay, that, you know what, that makes sense.
It does make sense, yeah, because, you know, again, this is let's see, this is the first one. So who's that in the big Japanese car dealing sushi from a German bar? Well, no one knows, but he won't get far. I took my tomahawk for a Satellite Walk. That's definitely, you know, that's something from my living room. And, you know, I mean, that's John. I took my tomahawk for a Satellite Walk. I mean, that's definitely, that's a Kaleism.
Hmm.
Who put the fishes in the deep blue sea? Who put the monkeys back in the tree? It wasn't you and it wasn't me. Who's been sleeping in my VCR? Who's been chewing on my PDR? I remember he wrote, who's been sleeping in my VCR? And I remember the PDR was a response to when I went to visit Graceland in Memphis.
Huh.
You know, they have you couldn't go. You could the tour of the house was just the first floor. You couldn't go up to his bedroom area, but they recreated his bedroom in a diorama kind of in the, on the first floor. So I remember the tour lady going, and this is Elvis's bedroom. If you look at it, he's got so many books because he was a scholar and he would read so much. And I looked at the books that were on his nightstand and it was like Jess Stern, right? Reincarnation, you know, all these kind of crazy, you know, fourth rate. Books about the occult and stuff.
Crackpot
like that.
Kind of shit.
Yeah, crack, definitely. And then there's the physician's desk reference.
Okay, you know, that's what PDR is.
Of course he's got that
okay.
bias because he's checking every pill he's taking.
Oh my gosh.
I remember putting that. It was truly like...
That's fantastic. Yeah, I've never known what the fuck PDR even was because my association is like PDA, right? Like the old like pre-iPhone kind of things, but that's right. Obviously not even what this is. So that's beautiful.
Yeah, so it's a physician's desk reference.
Yeah. I've read... There was a thing about how Lou Reed also, you know, this is a book that was well known to him.
I wonder why.
Something about like there was a period where like all he had was like that book and like that was like one of the few things he owned. And then there was just he was eating pints of ice cream all the time. So is this a song about murdering someone with a tomahawk?
Beats me.
That's a John. That's John. We got it. We're going to have to get John on and ask him.
Right. Yeah.
I'm sure he would appreciate me asking a question like that.
Yeah. Let's see who's sailing in the sailing in the Black Lagoon? Who's erasing the face of the man in the moon? That line also seems to be a line that we use something like that in the Sid and Nancy in the Nancy Spungen song. She took no for an answer. I think there was something with the man in the moon.
Oh well, that brings us to the end of the record. Really, fantastic album, I gotta say. You know, filled with just fantastic music, beautiful work from John in the studio, as well as obviously, as we've talked about, some just striking lyricisms from you, Ratso. You got any of the other statements or parting thoughts to leave us with on artificial intelligence, working with John in general, anything at all else?
Well, I mean, you know, it was a great, great experience. It was so much fun. I mean, of course, you know, you had a lot of fun those days in general, you sure. know, just drinking, doing not, you know, nefarious drugs. But I'm just, you know, thrilled to see, you know, how John has never stayed you know, in one place. It's just, you know, every album he, you know, he's like Dylan in that respect. I mean, you know, he's going to confound, you know, his fan base and, you know, do unexpected things.
Yeah.
And they'll follow him because, you know, it's the product is so great. And, you know, I was proud to be part of the Hallelujah thing with John because, you know, at the time, Leonard's manager, I mean, so-called manager Kelly, who eventually, you know, was charged with him, her and her accomplice were charged with embezzling all of that money from Leonard.
Mm.
But, you know, she had told me then that there was going to be a tribute album to Leonard. And, you know, they had a lot of indie. It was, I think it was part of Melody Maker or one of those British rock magazines. And they put out a final thing when you bought the that particular volume. But, so she said, you know, can you suggest anybody else? And I said, how about Cale? I'm working with him. And she says, that would be fantastic. So I called up John And I remember he said to me, you know, I'm not that familiar with Lennon's stuff, but what do you suggest?
Wow.
And I know, and I suggested that he do a poem of Lennon's that was put on, that was only on a live album called Queen Victoria and Me. I mean, you know, it's the kind of thing like a deep, deep, deep cut that nobody, you know, like Lou Reed doing Foot of Pride.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, I figured in that spirit, John can do Queen Victoria and Me. And it was, you know, Queen Victoria and he's Welsh and blah, blah, blah. So he, you know, he listens to that. And then we went to see Leonard at the, I think it was the Beacon. And that's when Leonard was doing Hallelujah Live. Mm-hmm. Right after that album finally came out, because Columbia had, you know, Yetnikoff, who's the head of Columbia, refused to put the album out in America. You know the story?
No.
Okay, so it's a horrific story, and again, it's told in the documentary about Leonard and Hallelujah that I have a pretty big role in, and it's available on Netflix. So I said, so Leonard starts singing this song, and John loves it. He goes, "This is fantastic! I want to do this song." And I said, "Not so fast." I said, "This is a completely new version of Hallelujah." Leonard, the album cut has almost totally different lyrics. What you should do is you should get both the album cut and, you know, the other lyrics, the live lyrics, which, you know, the album cut was a much more spiritual song set in biblical times, at least, you know, a couple of verses. And then the other one that he's doing on tour is a much more secular song. So I call up Kelly and say, maybe you could give John like as many lyrics, you know, because Leonard, for that song, it took Leonard 4 years at least, maybe more, to write all the lyrics of that song. He just showed me, at one point he showed me book after book after book, notebook, just scribblings. And they actually reproduce some. It's really fun to watch it on in the Netflix movie, because they have all the lines. And so I was up at Cale's house when I was living in the Village. And, you know, at that time, everybody had a fax machine. And you know how when faxes would come in, they would like start coming in and like pouring off the side, and sure. It was all the wrinkled paper, and it was all coming in. Anyway, the fax machine was gone for like 20 minutes.
Oh,
like, it was like hundreds and hundreds of verses to this song.
Oh my God.
So John then, like he did with you know, some of the songs on artificial intelligence, John then, you know, he's a great editor. And he just took these things and he edited into a version of Hallelujah.
Wow.
That was put on that that record.
And so he was literally just cutting and pasting different verses from Leonard's just fucking book length treatise on Hallelujah into his own version.
Well, I mean, he basically was combining the two versions.
Mm.
He was combining the beginning and the, you know, the more spiritual stuff that was from the album, and the stuff that he was doing on tour,
sure,
the live version, and it was, to me, you know, it was the best cover of that song.
Oh, well, it's more than just a cover. It's really it's a whole, you know, some covers they just do the song, and this was such a deeper engagement with what the song is, and kind of like really getting down to the root of what. Even what people think of the song now, I think John Cale's version is really one of the more well-known John Cale recordings.
It
turned out.
Made it into Shrek.
Made it into Shrek. Well, yes, but it's yeah. You know, it's also just fascinating that like one of the songs that, you know, you went the super deep cut route, which is like probably you know, what Ian or I, like if we were in your shoes, we might have been right. tempted to do that. But it's really something knowing that he wasn't aware of the song, and then, you know, it's kind of an all-timer that we all understand to be now. But just knowing that he had this fresh interaction with the song, seeing it be played, and then directly while it was like still hot, like molding it into his own interpretation, he's very much a part of the history of the song as much as yeah. and as you are, which is, you know, it's a really
and when he does it on the what was the album where he does it with just solo piano?
Fragments for a Rainy Season.
Fragments, yeah,
it's a terrific
version. I mean, that's just, I mean, he just owns
that's
that
as good
song.
As it gets.
Yeah, it is. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. And again, you know, record company bullshit. His version doesn't appear on the soundtrack
for Shrek.
Yeah, for Shrek. What? They used what's his name? Rufus Wainwright.
Oh,
because
man.
Rufus Wainwright was on the same label that was putting out the soundtrack album.
Oh.
Yeah, you're right.
I bet John missed out on a pretty penny from the fucking Shrek soundtrack sales
sure.
on that. God
I'm
damn.
Sure. And you know Jeff Buckley. I mean, a lot of people first came to that song through Jeff Buckley's version of it.
Mm-hmm.
But Jeff Buckley didn't even know it was a Leonard Cohen song. He thought it was a Cale song.
Wow.
When he was first, you know, was turned on to it by Hal Wilner. It was actually Leonard's version, John's version. So, yeah, no, to me, it's just great that, you know, John is still innovating and, you know, he's still just such an incredibly creative force. And long may he prosper.
Couldn't have said it any better myself. Thank you so much for joining us. Ratso, you got any plugs, anything people can check out for you out there?
Well, yeah, they could always go to www.ratso.org, and I have a merch store and sell my records and sell my books, and you know, I have a bunch of books that people seem to be interested in over the years, and go to Spotify and check out my music.
Check out the album. Indeed. We'll put links to everything in the episode description. Ladies and gentlemen, once again, Ratso Sloman, thank you so much. Ratso, true Renaissance man, a man equally comfortable writing songs with John Cale and writing about New York hockey teams and hanging out with Bob Dylan and hiring hookers for him in the combat zone of Boston. You've seen it all.
We're not hiring hookers for him, please.
No. Getting to know them, excuse
for
me.
For a movie.
For the movie, yes. I'm sorry.
It's always fun to talk to you guys. And if we have another album, let's get together again and we can talk about that.
Absolutely. We would love to have you back anytime.
I've been chasing ghosts and I don't like it. I wish someone would show me where to draw the line. I'd lay down my sword if you would take it and tell everyone back home I'm doing fine. I was with you down in Acapulco, trading clothing for some wine. Smelling like an old adobe woman or a William Burroughs painting for lost time. And I was thinking about my mother. I was thinking about what's mine. I was living like a Hollywood, but I was dying on the vine. Who could sleep through all that noisy chatter? The troops, the celebrations in the sun. And if I wasn't such a coward.